please the court, counsel, good morning. Ingrid DeFranco on behalf of David Corson. And I have the back to school cold despite being a grandmother. We're here, of course, because of a Brady violation. I came to wonder in preparing for this argument how ubiquitous those have become and how serious a problem they pose for our criminal justice system. And I will tell the court that I was unable to determine that for sure, but I can tell you a couple of things that may be interesting. If you Google the term Brady violation, you get 3.7 million hits in a third of a second. In 2008 and 2009, there were task force assembled in both New York and California to look into wrongful convictions. Each of them filed official reports, which are available online. And in each case, they determined that between 37% and 50% of wrongful convictions are attributable, at least in part, to Brady violations. I submit that's a very troubling statistic. This is not by any means the worst Brady violation that this court has ever had to deal with, but it's a very serious one. It's an egregious one. This was a Brady violation by a prosecutor who had personal knowledge of a tremendously involved and detailed story of a sexual assault by an attacker who never existed. And she stood before the court and defense counsel who trusted her and said, there's nothing there. I know that the trial court relied very heavily on the testimony of a counselor at Turning Point, Ms. DeRosby, to find that Mr. Corson had knowledge of this prior juvenile adjudication for false reporting. And I would submit that there are three very troubling facts about the trial court's factual finding. The first is that Mr. Roseby's testimony was entirely uncorroborated by any other person. The second is that the only piece of her testimony that defense counsel was able to test at all proved to be utterly false. And the third is that Mr. Roseby admitted during her testimony that she was not a counselor for this young woman, that she had no supervisory authority over her at all, but she somehow had this knowledge when the young woman's primary treating therapist at that institution didn't know a thing about it.
Mr. Franco, is your argument on this point that this witness is incredible as a matter of law?
Your Honor, I can't state that. I am very well aware of the standard to find a witness incredible as a matter of law. I can't do that. But I can say that the reason that an appellate court gives such deference to a trial court's factual findings is because the trial judge is in the position to watch the witness testify, watch the witness handle cross-examination, and make a warm, if you will, evaluation of that witness's credibility, and that's as it should be. But after the fact, when the trial court receives information that that witness has testified untruthfully from both the defense and the prosecution, both the defense and the prosecution submitted affidavits that stated that she had never made a request to find these notes in which she allegedly memorialized the conversation with Mr. Corson, then the trial court is in a position of having to do something with that information because it contradicts what he believed that he saw from her on the stand, and he ignored them. That says that this court does not give the deference to those factual findings that it would in a normal case. Because the witness's credibility and the court's perception of the witness's credibility is very badly damaged by those after-submitted affidavits.
Mr. Franco, let me ask you another question. You stated that the prosecution represented there was nothing there, and I'd like you to address that a little bit. I know that the defense made requests for the discovery information, but the response to that was Rule 16 requires automatic disclosure, and what's beyond Rule 16 we're not required to disclose.
In addition, excuse me, we have followed the law. We will follow the law. These motions should be stricken as improper. And then Mr. Gabaldon, who was defense counsel, testified that she gave him personal assurances that the information had been disclosed and that he trusted her because he'd known her for many, many years. So her representations to both the court and to counsel were untrue. This isn't a case where there's an inadvertent Brady violation, and I'm aware that the Supreme Court says it doesn't matter, but this is a case where she had direct personal knowledge. She prosecuted this young woman 3 times in 2 years. The last prosecution was based on both a theft from an employer and this false report of a sex assault, complete with a full report from the City of Loveland Police Department on the, as I recall that police report, the witness described the plaid of the attacker's shirt right down to the colors. So that this was not somebody jumped out of the bushes, attacked me and ran away. This was a very, very carefully orchestrated prior false report. And I'm aware that the government spent a lot of its brief defending the actions of the prosecutor and suggesting that these disclosures didn't have to be made. I believe as a matter of law that's incorrect. But had the prosecutor believed that these juvenile adjudications and their substance, and that's of course the problem, were not properly discoverable, we know what had to happen. She had to tell the court, I have information, I don't believe it's proper to disclose it, I'm not disclosing it. The court then would have had to make a determination about whether that disclosure had to be made for an in-camera review, and he would have made a determination about whether or not that had to be released to the defense. It is unimaginable to me that the trial court would not have assured that the information regarding the prior false report would not have been disclosed to the defense. He might have barred the defense from bringing out the fact that she was adjudicated, although under Alaska versus Davis, it's not at all clear how he could have barred the defense from bringing out the fact that she was on parole at the time the allegations were made, and that there was, let me make sure I get this right, I believe it was later that she told the defense investigator that she was threatened with revocation of her parole if she attempted to retract the allegations. This young woman told so many stories that we don't know if that was true or that was not true. But at some point, she made that allegation in a sworn affidavit that she was threatened with revocation of her parole for that.
Mr. Franco, may I ask you, I want to make sure I understand your argument. You've got 2 points here, the Brady violation and the ineffective. So there's 2 pieces I want to make sure I get. I think your position is, even if Mr. Corson had some knowledge of this information, it doesn't matter. It's that his, you know, they were entitled, the lawyer was entitled to know there's documentary evidence backing him up. And I think your argument is that the misrepresentation by the government, I'm forgetting the exact words of the case law, but effectively induced the ineffective assistance. It was because of that. So number one, is that right? And number two, if that's right, it seems to me the court really didn't address the rights, the court below didn't address the right species of ineffective assistance. The court didn't address this kind of causing the ineffective assistance of counsel, just kind of mal the Strickland, language. And I guess my question is, if we were to agree with you and the court didn't address the species of ineffective you're relying on, what's our remedy? Do we need to remand to ask the court to find facts based on the correct theory?
I think this court can do it because it's a matter of law, and review of the trial court's legal rulings is de novo. So this court can do a de novo review and make that finding one way or another. So in response to your first question, yes. Mr. Gabaldon suspected, and that's clear from the motion that he filed, that there was at least one prior false allegation. Even had Mr. Corson known or remembered that he had been told there was an actual adjudication for prior false reporting and told his counsel that. Once the prosecutor said there's nothing there, how was the defense to find it? These are juvenile records. This isn't a case where I can send my investigator to go through court files. And certainly I can do that in a normal case. I can do an accurate, I can find out if a prosecution witness has ever been arrested and what the outcome of the case is. But in a juvenile case, he has no way to investigate with the police agencies or the courts a prior adjudication. He's stuck once that representation is made, and he cannot bring a motion until he has some corroboration that what his client tells him is correct. And that's why it's so serious in this case, because even if Mr. Corson had had full knowledge, there would have been no way for the defense to use that knowledge.
Ask a different line of questions. In this particular case, the real issue is, as I understand it, defendant admits that he did have sexual relations with this young woman.
That's correct.
The question is whether she was over or under 18 at the time this occurred. He did have access to her records, even though he wasn't a counselor, apparently. He did have some access to her records, did he not?
His testimony was that he had access to files for purposes of filing only, to put documents in them, unless the client was someone that he personally counseled. And he testified, and even Ms. DeRosby agreed with this, that he had no personal responsibility for counseling her. He only had that general, you know, he would be the house counselor on occasion.
Right, but he did have some access to information about this young woman.
That is correct, according.
Now, the time frame, as I understood it, was that these assaults occurred sometime between April 28th and September 12th, 2001. On September 12, 2001, she would have turned 18. And that's, about 5 months?
That's correct.
In having access to his records, wouldn't he also know about her date of birth?
His testimony, and no one was able to offer any contrary testimony, was that if it was an individual for whom he didn't have a counseling responsibility, his access to the file was to file papers in it, and that he did not have authority to read the file, and that in fact he had not.
Even if he hadn't, he knew personally when these sexual encounters occurred.
Yes.
And he pleaded guilty. So he must have known whether they occurred before September 12, 2001.
Well, Your Honor, unfortunately, my clients are often in the position, particularly in cases that carry a life sentence, where they're in an Alford position. They will plead guilty on a sentence concession to avoid a terrible result. And the United States Supreme Court in the last year and a half has addressed this issue twice and said that in the case of someone facing a draconian sentence who's offered a plea on much more favorable terms, that it's the job of counsel to assess that risk and to adequately advise them when they should accept a guilty plea regardless of actual innocence, and that when counsel does not do that, counsel has been ineffective. And Mr. Gavaldon testified that that's what happened here. He told him, you've got to take the plea.
coming back to what I asked you in terms of the remedy, don't we need some more factual findings on that? Don't we need testimony that had I known this, you know, my counsel had this information and advised me I would have done something different on the correct standard? I mean, my concern is, you know, it seems like the judge was relying, with due respect to the judge who I admire, was not relying on the right legal standard. And I understand there are legal questions here, but I'm not, there seems to be factual issues that need to get decided. Did, in fact, the government's misconduct here induce the ineffective assistance of counsel? That really was never addressed.
You're right. The trial court used the Leavitt standard and said that I don't find it credible that he wouldn't have gone to trial, despite Mr. Gabaldon's testimony that they discussed this. I forget how many times he said, but it was an inordinate number of times, and that Mr. Corson relied on him to advise him and followed his advice. So I'm always hesitant to suggest a remand, especially when I think that the court can make findings as a matter of law, but that's your call.
I appreciate your candor. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Brady.
May it please the court, I'm Christine Brady, registration number 24779, representing the people.
Ms. Brady, can I just ask you a procedural question before you jump in?
Yes.
I saw the briefs that Ms. Pettigrew was going to appear. Have you entered an appearance in this case?
I did. I substituted as counsel.
My apologies.
About a month ago. Okay. Thank you. Since the defense concedes that Ruiz basically applies to this case and that there was no duty to disclose, we're really left with the issue of the misrepresentation. It seems that the 35C court was not aware of Ruiz, and so his order might have been quite different had he been aware of Ruiz. We don't know if the DA, the original DA who responded to the defense motions for discovery, we don't know if she was aware of Ruiz or not. That case came out a month before the defendant was ever charged, so it was obviously controlling law at the time.
Ms. Brady, let me just ask you something procedurally.
Yes.
What happened before the trial court. So I understand when you're referring to Ruiz, that is a case that says that there may not be a constitutional obligation to disclose prior to plea bargaining.
It makes it a rule. It doesn't say may. It says the rule is no matter what the facts of the case are, no matter what the plea agreement says. And the reason why it is a rule, regardless of the facts, is because the duty to disclose material impeachment information, like the information in this case, is tied to having a fair trial. You cannot have a fair trial without the disclosure of material impeachment.
So let me just interrupt for one moment there. All right, so then procedurally what happened here is defendant entered into a plea and entered into that plea about 4 days before the scheduled trial.
I think that's correct. It was after the DNA evidence came back showing that he was indeed having a sexual relationship with the victim.
All right, so then my question is, did the prosecution have a duty to disclose Brady material 4 days before the scheduled trial?
If, in fact, the defense had announced ready for trial, then at that point, things change because you are now going to trial. And yes, there would have been a duty to disclose had the defendant, that's the turning point there. Had the defendant, you know, if the plea agreement deadline had passed and it was clear that he was not pleading guilty and everyone was preparing and ready for trial, then yes, there was a duty at that point under Ruiz.
All right, and then let me ask you, under Rule 16, what is the requirement prior to the trial date for disclosure?
Under Rule 16, Ruiz is kind of an umbrella of this is the constitutional duties. If there's no constitutional duty, then obviously there's not going to be a duty under a procedural rule.
Well, while you stop,
yes.
Let me pick up on that.
Yes.
I think Mr. Franco may have argued this, I'm sure she would argue it, that Ruiz is distinguishable here, even if there's no constitutional obligation to provide this. The prosecutor can't mislead the defendant into pleading. And as I understand the argument, is that's what happened here. Does Ruiz control that situation? And if not, what do we do with the fact that there are at least facts to support an argument that the prosecutor misled the defense lawyer?
Okay. Ruiz does not actually talk about misrepresentation. So that was not addressed there. So the fact that the defense is arguing that there was misrepresentation, that is a separate claim, and that is in relation to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. In regard to that, there was no affirmative misrepresentation. There were actually two different responses that the DA gave to the many, many motions in this case for discovery. One motion for discovery just talked about medical history and treatment records from Turning Point. Another of the motions talked about the impeachment information that we're discussing here, the prior adjudication for false reporting of sex abuse. Okay, so the first response was to the medical records, and it's clear from her response that she is just talking about medical records. And that is the response where she talked about, no, that's privileged, and you're going on a fishing expedition. That's where all of that language is, and that's language that the defense relies on for their argument of misrepresentation. But the fact was, she did not have any medical history information that was discoverable, and I would argue she didn't have any information at all about the medical history.
Ms. Brady, so given that, and I understand what you're saying, that prosecution may not have had possession of medical records and the records may have been privileged, my understanding in the motion that was filed by defense counsel, it said under information and belief, we believe there's a history of false reporting. And then in the response to that, albeit it's about medical records, the response is this is a fishing expedition. And so would it have been arguable that response was inclusive of we have information and belief there may have been a history of false reporting?
I would say no, because she filed a separate motion. I'm sorry, a separate response to the motion. And in that, she directly addressed what was automatically disclosable. And she asked for that particular motion to be stricken. Now, of course, none of this was litigated. It wasn't stricken. The trial court didn't make any findings or rulings. No one talked about in-camera review or anything of that type, because when the DNA evidence came back, the defendant decided to plead guilty. Also, as you know from the record, the DA left after, I think it was 2 months or so after all of this occurred, and went on to be a magistrate, and we had a new prosecutor. And there were just at that point, none of these issues were litigated or talked about with the new prosecutor. The defendant's attorney testified at the 35C hearing. He was basically assuming and going on the reputation of the original DA they had worked together for a long time, and he was assuming that she had nothing in her possession. But there was no affirmative misrepresentation that they had something, that they did not have something that they in fact did have.
So let me ask about the other motion then, because there was the motion that was requesting felony convictions, juvenile adjudications. It was the general request for impeachment information.
Correct.
And the response to that was either it's automatically discoverable under Rule 16 or beyond Rule 16, we don't have to turn it over.
Correct.
All right. So at the post-conviction hearing, the district court made a ruling, or at least a statement, saying that juvenile adjudications are not discoverable, and everybody proceeded along.
As general impeachment, they are not, and that's correct law.
All right. So I'd like you to discuss that. I mean, you said as general impeachment,
correct.
But then I understand with Davis versus Alaska,
correct.
There may be exceptions to that. So I'd like you to address that court's ruling that the juvenile adjudications would not be discoverable.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure how much I can address that because there wasn't a big discussion of it. It was just basically it's general impeachment information. It's a prior juvenile adjudication. Are there circumstances? Yes, there are circumstances, but of course, none of that got litigated. So, is it possible that this prior adjudication would have come in? It's possible, but it's just kind of out there. I mean, what about Rape Shield? So if and Rape Shield wasn't really discussed, it didn't go. I mean, we don't have any facts in regard to that. Is it possible that it was, you know, it could have been admissible at trial? So that it was just, yes, it's definitely a possibility.
Can you address Ms. Brady, Ms. DeFranco's argument here? You know, basically what the defense counsel said, I didn't even know this information existed. I guess what I'm asking you is to address the finding that the defendant had information about this history. Mr. Franco says it's not relevant because the issue is counsel didn't know, and counsel had no document, and counsel has some duty to, you know, when the prosecutor says there is nothing or suggests there is nothing, counsel really can't follow up on that. And that rendered counsel ineffective. So would you address that argument, and the question I asked Mr. Franco, did the court apply the right standard here? I'm not sure the court applied the law that says, you know, a prosecutor can render defense counsel ineffective. Your answer brief makes the usual Strickland argument. Hey, they said he's a great lawyer. They've conceded he's fine. And really don't address, I think, the render ineffective part. Would you address that?
I don't think that counsel can be rendered ineffective in these circumstances, especially if, as the trial court found, the defendant had information and didn't release that to, and that was the testimony of the attorney. Defendant never told him about this prior adjudication for false reporting. And I think, yes, he was a great lawyer, but that's not really what the trial court based it on. The trial court based it on the fact that with everything that the defense attorney knew, he made a reasonable recommendation to the defendant. And that's all he could do. It's not deficient performance if, with all the information that he has, and that leaves aside the misrepresentation. Okay, misrepresentation brings in a different element, and I agree with that. But just the basic Strickland argument, no, you don't look to see what other people did to see if the advice was reasonable. It was the information that he had at the time, therefore there's no deficient.
But I guess I'll take you up on your exclusion. Don't we have to look, at least there are allegations and testimony supporting the argument of misrepresentation that I think the court didn't weigh. You know, couldn't a reasonable fact finder here say, yes, you didn't disclose that. Yes, had the lawyer known that, his recommendation would have been way different. This woman is, you know, diagnosed pathological liar. She's got all these convictions, falsely accusing someone of sexual abuse. Same charge here. And, you know, can't the court weigh that in to say, on those facts, had you disclosed this information, he would have taken a different tact, and that's ineffective assistance.
Well, I think the court could have done that analysis, but the sticky thing there is, was there a duty to disclose? If there wasn't, then you have to show there was an affirmative misrepresentation that induced. And if there's an argument that there is an affirmative misrepresentation, then I think the trial court did need to address that. You know, did that induce the defense attorney's assessment of the case and what he told the defendant that the defendant should do, which was plead guilty. The problem is down below, I don't recall him making an argument that there was an affirmative misrepresentation. They relied on these responses to the motions, and we didn't have any testimony at the 35C hearing from the district attorney who did the responses. And I do not think, that, and I know the defense said this, but I do not remember the defense attorney at the 35C hearing saying that he had personal assurances that this information did not exist. I don't think that was the testimony. The testimony was they told me they had nothing discoverable. I relied on that because of all of the years I've known that she wouldn't misrepresent or whatever. I don't think there was a full-blown argument down below that there was an affirmative misrepresentation, and that is possibly why the trial court did not address that aspect in its order. There are no further questions?
I do have one question. Okay. If we were to look at the record, and if indeed there was an argument made for that, but the court didn't make findings on it, can we address it ourselves, or would we need to remand for the court to make findings?
I think you can address it yourselves, because you do have all the testimony from the 35C hearing. If you remanded for findings, it would be based on the evidentiary hearing that they've already had.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your very helpful arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.